Welcome to this episode of On The Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Tan. In each episode, we speak to various professionals and experts to gain insight into legal careers, law school, and other exciting developments in the world of law. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show.
Everyone, my name is Antonio Val. I'm a first-year law student here at the LSE, and also one of the hosts of our podcast. I'm very pleased to announce that joining us today, we have Dr. Miguel Poyas Maduro. He is currently the Dean of the Católica Law School in Lisbon and has an extensive academic background as a research scholar in the Harvard Law School, a law professor in the European University Institute in Florence, as well as in Yale, the Institute of European Studies of Macau, the Chicago Law School, the College of Europe in Brussels, and the Center of Constitutional Studies of Madrid, amongst many others. Most importantly, he was also a visiting professor between 2004 and 2008 at the London School of Economics itself. And today he is here to share a bit of his experience and to talk to us about the current state of the European Union and what the future of this important organization will be. But just before we move on and to further contextualize our listeners, our guest here today has also been the Portuguese Minister for Regional Development and an Attorney General at the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg. Other than all of this, he has written a series of books where he analyzes the European Union from a legal perspective, discusses the role of the ECJ and European constitutionalism, and talks about the future of EU law. Okay, I promise that I'm done with introductions, but the reason why I mentioned these experiences amongst many others is because they really show that you have had an immense exposure to the law through a wide variety of contexts. So before we start, you have gone from academics and research to teaching to working as an attorney general, and even to understanding the interplay between law and politics, an extremely diversified zigzagging career that definitely allowed you to deeply and intrinsically understand the law. From all of these experiences, what was your preferred interaction with the law, and what did you enjoy the most doing?
It's hard to say what is my favorite one. I have to, it's like looking at a beautiful monument and asking to be chosen which part of the monument you like more, when in fact it's the ensemble, the coherent aspect of that monument, of that building that actually makes it so unique. So I really enjoyed having to engage with the law, but not only with politics, in reality with life, in those different ways. Each one of them gave me an insight and gave me an opportunity also to interact and to try to make a difference in different ways, all of which were very important to me, and all of which actually added to my overall understanding of the law in that case. To a large extent, I think I'm a better practitioner of the law by having been also in a court or by having been a legislator. I think I am a better legislator because I have been in a court. I think I was a better advocate general at the Court of Justice, and therefore a better member of the court, because I also had the distance of being an academic and a law professor that gave me a different vision of the law. What I think it's crucial for us to enjoy those functions, but also to do them well, is to understand that each of those functions are different. And by being different means that they often require you to use a different language, to act in a different way, to take into account that you are operating in a different context and with a different community of people and actors. And so that means that you need to do and interact with the law in a different way, but it also means that you are able to do it better if, while using the language that is expected in that context, while acting in the way that is normally effective in that context, you do it with the information, with the knowledge that comes from having practiced and interacted with the law in other contexts.
I also can't help but notice that your career started in a Portuguese law firm where you worked before going to the European University Institute. What was the reason behind this shift, and what is the reason behind your passion for European affairs and European law?
Well, already when I went to the law firm, I was there for a short period of time doing my traineeship. But when I went there, I already went there pretty sure that I was going to leave soon to do a PhD. So I went there, and I, at the same time, I was applying to do a PhD. And the reason was because at the time in particular, and I think throughout my life, I was very much interested in research. And so I like practicing the law too. I've liked very much even to do consultancy. I'd sometimes do that in cases. I love that part of the law too. I have to say that when you work in a law firm, you get both a couple of very interesting cases and many cases that are much less interesting. So being a researcher, I'm able to choose what I want to work in the law. And I think that that was a crucial aspect of why I developed more that part of my career. Why EU law was a function of an interest I had, but it was also a function of the fact that I wanted to go to do the PhD outside Portugal. Was not very common at the time, particularly for lawyers. And the best place to do it, basically the PhD recognized in Portugal, was the European University Institute. And so I thought that going to the UI, I immediately thought that it would be better to do a topic on EU law. So that drove me to EU law in a certain way. And I really loved the area. And so I basically, it's an initial flirt that converted into a long-term relationship, basically.
Now I'm going to shift a bit the conversation towards the EU as a whole. We have seen over the last few years a growth in Euroscepticism, as well as just a general lack of interest and faith in the EU by the average citizen. The most obvious sign is the steady decline in turnouts for the EU Parliament elections, experienced mainly amongst the younger age groups. What do you think is the reason behind this? Do you feel like there is a gap between the workings of the EU and the average European citizen, that the average person looks at the EU without knowing very well what it does and how it affects our lives?
Certainly, that is one of the problems. But it is important that we understand that what we mean by that gap between the citizens and the European Union, because to a large extent, that gap also exists in national politics, where people increasingly don't really feel that they have an actual voice in their political systems at the levels of their states, at national level, where they don't really feel represented by the political system. So that gap exists in both places. I think at the level of the EU, is mostly the fact that we have a lot of mechanisms of democratic input, contrary to what some people sometimes portray. I mean, you have direct elections to the European Parliament. You have democratic representation through your national governments in the Council. You have mechanisms of collective participation and direct participation at the EU level, to right of initiative of citizens, for example, the right petitions, a variety of instruments, the level of transparency that you often don't have in the national political process. So to a large extent, I don't think we can say that the European Union suffers from this very generalized and systemic democratic deficiencies. What happens is that its real deficiency is more on a political nature. That is, all these democratic instruments that exist at EU level operate without the existence of a genuine political space. That is, people don't know what are the positions of the left and the right in general in Europe, don't engage in European discussions beyond their national confines. So to a large extent, European politics is framed in a context of national politics. And it's that often means that citizens feel distanced, don't feel engaged, and they feel that the only option that they have with respect to the European Union is to be for or against the European Union, instead of feeling involved on the political debates that are taking place in the European Union. Political debates that are not simply about whether we want more or less Europe, but what kind of environmental policies do we want? What kind of food safety policies do we want? And that they are not sufficiently engaged. So I think that's definitely one of the problems, but it's not the only problem. And I think that the Union is facing a moment of its existence where its traditional forms of legitimation that were mostly a legitimation through the outputs, through what it gave to citizens in terms of guaranteeing peace in Europe after the Second World War, and in terms of economic development, growth, and economic convergence. And it was the biggest periods of economic growth and economic convergence in Europe were after the European integration and after the creation of the European communities. Those two elements are at least stagnated they've lost their immediate appeal. They are not as visible as before to the European citizens. And the European Union has not been able to develop an alternative form of legitimacy, an alternative form of showing itself to be relevant in general terms to European citizens. And if we connect that to a more broader challenge that we see to democracies in general at the national level, then that all that contributes to the problems that the Union faces. And this general problem of democracy is a problem that we see it in the decreased levels of satisfaction with democratic regimes by EU citizens. People still prefer democracies to any other political regimes, but they consistently show a decreasing satisfaction with how their democratic regimes are operating. And people increasingly don't feel represented, as I said before, by their political systems. That explains the growth of populists, for example. This is a problem that's affecting national democracies above all, but that is also impacting indirectly in the EU level. So all these factors contribute to the problems that the union faces today. And I think the question the union has in face of it is, how can it reconstruct its legitimacy by reconstructing its added value in the eyes of its citizens?
And also, I can't help but notice that as a minister of regional development, you have a great contact with people in less urbanized areas. And do you feel that those people in those regions that aren't the capital or the main cities of a country, they feel like the EU doesn't reach out to them, that the EU does not care about their needs and does not promote an equitable growth within the member states?
First, one has to be careful in drawing conclusions from the case of my country, Portugal. This is one of the countries where normally the union still continues to be overwhelmingly more popular than impopular. So one will need to be careful with that. But I would say that the real problem that I see with the European Union, it's there are strong opposition, but from a really small minority groups. The problem is that strong opposition from that very limited minorities on the other side doesn't have an equal active and mobilized group supporting the European Union, but mostly people that are not engaged with the European Union. So to a large extent, what I would say is that for the most part, people don't really relate in the distant parts, in the less urban parts. They don't really relate with the European Union. They don't really feel it as a daily part of their life, even if there is. And that's why I was saying that we need to trigger a form of making European politics part of the daily life of people and to let them perceive the extent to which they are part of a new political community where politics is taking place and they can have the instruments to be active in this political discourse.
So you believe that the solution is to make people aware of the existence of these instruments?
Well, yes and no. Yes, they need to be aware, but I'm very careful in with using that expression because it might seem that the only problem is a problem of communicating new policies. And that's often one of the mistakes that is made. Oh, people don't get to know Europe. Let's do a campaign on television that tells people how Europe is relevant to their lives. That doesn't work. What we need is to design policies and to design political instruments that really lead to people engage politically with the European Union. And that's a substantially different thing and much harder to develop than a communication campaign, a dissemination of information about what the EU is doing or not doing. It requires a change in the political culture and in the political instruments that shape that political culture of the European Union.
We'll now shift a bit the conversation towards EU law. And to begin with, a couple of weeks ago or months ago, just minutes away from where I live in London, there was a woman in a six-week internship who wanted to completely scrap all remaining EU laws by the end of 2023 in the UK. Well, we obviously have to let her off the hook because fortunately she was only there for a short period of time. But it does raise an important question. What do you feel are the main advantages of the EU law and what is its role in ensuring unity amongst member states?
I think that the legal certainty and the what distinguishes EU law from international law, it's the fact that it complies with the fundamental aspects of the rule of law in a constitutional order, mostly and above all, equality under the law. That is, supremacy and direct effect, existential requirements of EU law, and that made it so hard for some politicians to accept it, particularly in the UK, the idea that you could have the law of the European Union to prevail over domestic law, above all, to guarantee equality under the law. And all that flows from a system that is based on equality under the law, that is based on the rule of law, on the idea that all have the certainty that everybody is both equally subject to the same rules and equally entitled to the same rights. It was these that created the framework, the ground for the success of the process of European integration through so many years. And that's what I think it's so crucial and so important in the unique character of the European Union legal order. So the attempts to undermine supremacy, the attempts to undermine direct effect are from a point of view extremely dangerous. And they don't exist only in the most extreme form of a country leaving the European Union, as it happened with the UK. They, unfortunately, they are also occurring with some challenges that we are increasingly seeing in some current members of the European Union. And one has to be mindful and careful of how important those requirements are. Then, EU law, I mean, is good or bad as to its substance. And I will argue that for the most part, the quality of the legislative process in the European Union, its rationality, the quality of its deliberation, as in many respects, provides guarantees as to the quality of the legislation, as to the substantive quality of the legislation that many times probably you don't have at national level. You have a degree. What makes it so hard to adopt legislation in the European Union is also what makes it subject to a degree of scrutiny, checks and balances, that often makes of that legislation of higher quality than what you might have in many national cases.
And we will talk about some of the problems that currently exist with EU law in member states in a while. But before, I would just like to talk a bit about the European Court of Justice as well. So we know that the ECJ, in a way, is a mix between the French Cour de Cassation, for example, and the American Supreme Court. And we also know that the French style works in France because people trust the system and they know the judges and where they come from. They know the school from which they come from. At the same time, the American system works in the US because judgments are of the entire responsibility of judges. And there is a very detailed reasoning behind sentences. Do you think that by trying to combine both, the ECJ ends up by losing the advantages of each?
No, I think it combines the advantages of both. I have a rather positive perspective on that. I think it was not intentional that the Court of Justice could somehow be seen as reconciling the French model of judicial deliberation and judicial reasoning with the American model. I think that's a very smart construction and summary done by Michael Leiser, trying to make sense of how the European Court of Justice works. But probably the Court of Justice arrived at this style of deliberation and reasoning as a consequence of the institutional rules regarding how the court operates that are in the treaty and the historical development. But let me give you an example of where I think, for example, for the Court of Justice actually presents a better summary than those two courts. One of the problems with French courts and French judicial reasoning is that you don't have dissenting votes. The reasoning of the courts is often very short, very not substantiated, and they are criticized by that. But on the other hand, you look at the US Supreme Court, and it's true, they have very developed judicial opinions, they have dissenting votes, so you can see the different perspectives within the court. But the reality is that the Supreme Court has become a court where judges don't reason with each other anymore. They simply vote and then they express their positions without trying to reach a compromise. And deliberation, and we would expect that from courts, from judges to be open to be convinced by other judges to try to reach at a common solution. And that is completely missing from the US Supreme Court on how it has evolved. In the Court of Justice, you tend to have a bit the two things, because the judgments themselves have a pull towards compromise, consensus, because judges cannot have dissenting votes, so there's an attempt to do that. But on the other hand, you have the opinions of the advocate generals that are much more developed. So you also have some degree of pluralism and transparency as to that pluralism within the court. So I think that in many respects, I mean, sure, the Court of Justice is far from being a perfect court, and its reasoning could improve in many respects. But I think that there are aspects where it provides a better approach than the one that you see in the French court or the US Supreme Court.
Yeah, the reason why I was talking about this is because this issue came recently again in light of what is currently going on with Poland. We know that in 2021, the ECJ questioned the independence of judges in Poland, and the Polish prime minister responded by questioning EU law as a whole. And now there is currently a clash between the Supreme Court in Poland and the ECJ. How do you see these clashes, and how can we guarantee judicial harmony within Europe, and how can we guarantee accountability within the different member states?
I think both judiciaries, national judiciaries and the European Court of Justice judiciaries, have to recognize that it is very important to protect the distinctive and existential requirements of the EU legal order, including its supremacy, its direct effect, its uniform application. And national judiciaries need to understand this. On the other hand, the European Court of Justice needs to understand that in order for that to be the case, that they have to be sensitive to the requirements flowing from different national legal orders. And I think that to a large extent, they have been. Both national judiciaries and the Court of Justice have been so. And that's why, so far, those kinds of risks of conflict have throughout the history been very limited, that really make it the exception, not the rule, and have therefore not affected the character of EU law. I think the case with Poland is different because, to a large extent, the Polish Constitutional Court challenging the European Court of Justice is no longer an independent judiciary itself. And so that has to be read in a different light, has to be read as a conflict, I think, of a court, the European Court of Justice, with a political system that is trying to interfere in judicial independence, and not as a conflict between two judiciaries that are trying to protect their respective legal orders. I'm confident that in spite of the problems, the tensions that exist regularly, with respect to tensions between national judiciaries and the European Court of Justice, they will continue to drive what I described as constitutional pluralism. That doesn't mean recognition of divergence of the right of national judiciaries to diverge, but instead a requirement for both the European Court of Justice and national judiciaries to negotiate and accommodate their respective claims in a way that protects at the same time the uniform application of EU law in all the legal orders.
Similarly, there is also a recent case study in Hungary when the Hungarian parliament restricted freedom of speech and limited freedom to education by preventing LGBTQ content from being featured in schools. What remedy is there for countries that violate the rule of law and contradict the fundamental values upheld by the EU? So what power does the EU have over these countries?
There is no magic bullet. I mean, when you have an entire political regime diverting into an autocratic regime, moving away from the rule of law, there is no silver bullet, no magic solution. You have to operate with different levels. And one of them is the European Court of Justice, and one of them is EU law. And I think it is increasingly visible that you need to use hard law mechanisms. So the initial approach of the European Union is that we have a nuclear deterrent in the form of Article 7 of the possibility to suspend a member state from the European Union. But it's set up in such a way that it's a huge deterrent, but without being effective, therefore not to be applied, doesn't work. The alternative of just engaging politically in a conversation, mechanisms such as the rule of law dialogue, the interaction between institutions and these member states also are not enough. You need to set up a variety of instruments, and I think some of them are already in place, such as the conditionality of the funds and all that. Other ones are being developed by the court, including something that I myself defended in the kind of an opinion before the Court of Justice when I was Advocate General in Centro Europa 7, and that the court to a large extent adopted in the case against Poland. That is the idea that certain violations of fundamental rights and the rule of law in member states put into question the capacity of that member state to comply with EU law obligations themselves, and therefore they can be sanctioned by the Court of Justice. And I think this needs to be exploited further by the Commission in bringing infringement actions and by the court itself. That is another instrument, a hard law mechanism. But I also think that another thing that hasn't been used enough and needs to be used more is that the Union itself, as in a variety of areas, the capacity to impose on this state the existence of independent bodies that are linked to the application of different areas of the EU law. I mean, think about the central banks, but that you can apply in other areas, whereby the Union can guarantee and protect the independence of these bodies. And why is this important? Because it means that even in those regimes, the Union makes sure there are checks and balances that stay in place, because these bodies' independence is protected by the EU itself. And the Union needs to be more assertive in doing this with respect to central banks, but needs to do it stronger with respect to other bodies too.
That is a really interesting alternative. Just in light of these two case studies, do you feel like there is a huge problem when law and politics start mixing within different countries? Or do you feel that the interplay between both is extremely important?
Well, I mean, first, I think the interplay between law and politics is absolutely natural, because they operate in the same fields. They have different ways of acting in social life. They are different decision-making procedures. They are based on different institutions. One, a political process that is directly accountable to the people. Another one, courts that are independent. And so they operate, but they both are acting in the same social spheres. And so that interplay is a normal thing. It's like two different persons with very different personalities that have to do something together or they are living in the same building. And so those conflicts are natural. What is important is for law to acknowledge and courts to acknowledge the different nature of politics and its own legitimacy, and to acknowledge precisely that when they are applying the law, they are interacting with politics. And so courts have always to be attentive on the extent to which they really have a competitive institutional advantage when they are acting and when they are, for example, setting aside the decision of the political process. Are they really in a better institutional position to decide those issues than the political process is? And vice versa with the political process. It needs to acknowledge the specific legitimacy of law and the courts. And I think that's what is important. Tensions in this context are a normal thing.
Thank you. We're already reaching the end of our conversation. I'd just like to ask you one question. In light of everything that we've spoken about, what do you feel is the future of the EU? What message would you give to the future generations? And how can we ensure that the Article 50 of the Treaty of Lisbon is not invoked again?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, the situation that's happening and developing in the UK makes a very strong case to the other member states not to take the same path and to invoke that provision. But I think it's even more important that the Union lives and is supported by its citizens, not out of fear, that is, out of fear for what will happen if we leave the Union, but out of enthusiasm, out of embracement for the advantages that people realize and attribute to the European Union. So I think this is the real challenge that the Union has ahead of it. And I can't develop much, but I'll give you a hint and advertise the book I'm working on that is based precisely on the many counterintuitive assumption that the Union is actually the best source of democratic added value to citizens of European states in light of the challenges that their national democracies face at the moment. So if you want to use an expression that has become famous in the UK, the best way to take back control democratically in Europe is through the European Union in many respects. And that's the purpose of my book. And that's what I think the Union needs to make more visible to citizens. What's the democratic added value that it brings to them in this current day and age?
Thank you very much. Just as a final question, from all your experience in law and practicing the law, what advice would you give to a first year law student who is taking his first steps into the law?
Be curious. It should be curiosity that should drive you. If you are curious, if you are not afraid to make the most basic questions, I always say there's no more powerful question than why. Why are things like this? That will shape your career. That will make it much more interesting for you to do the work that you do. So it much more easily transforms work into pleasure, and it will make you much more successful in your future career. So that will be my advice. Be curious and don't be afraid to make all questions.
Thank you so much for being with us today. It was a huge pleasure to talk with you and to learn with you. I would also like to take this opportunity to recommend a highly interesting interview called Talks on the Future of Justice. It was conducted by Dr. Poyaj Maduro and hosted the German Constitutional Court Judge Susan Bayer, as well as the former Italian Minister of Justice, Marta Cartabia. The discussion was fantastic, and it is extremely relevant for any law students or generally anyone who is curious about the law.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning into this episode of On the Case, the LSC Law Society's podcast. Further information and our contact details can be found in the description of this episode. Don't forget to follow us at LSCSU Law Soc on Instagram or on LinkedIn at LSC's On the Case. See you next time.